This episode features discussions of kidnapping and the physical, emotional, and sexual abuse of a child that some people may find offensive. Listener discretion is advised, especially for children under 13.
On August 23, 2002, 21-year-old Michelle Knight was desperate. She had been trying to find her way to the social service office in downtown Cleveland, Ohio for hours. And now it was just after 2 p.m. She was going to be late.
Michelle was headed to an appointment with her caseworker that would prepare her for an important custody hearing the following week. She was seeking to regain guardianship of her 2-year-old son, Joey. If she missed the meeting, she ran the risk of losing custody permanently.
In a fateful decision, one that would haunt her for the rest of her life, Michelle turned down the social services offer to supply her with a ride. Instead, she asked a family member to drive her to the important meeting. But the relative had inexplicably canceled just a few hours before, leaving Michelle stranded.
Though she had no driver's license and no money, Michelle was determined to make the meeting. So she set out by foot. She recruited her cousin, Deanna, to make the journey downtown with her. But after nearly 2 hours of walking in the scorching August heat, the young women were dehydrated, exhausted, and confused. They could not find the address listed on Michelle's official documents.
Deanna and Michelle eventually split up. Wandering around helplessly, with time quickly ticking away, Michelle found herself in the neighborhood Family Dollar store. It's where she had bought her son Christmas presents the year before.
Inside, Michelle asked several people in the store for directions, but no one could help her. Michelle was exasperated and on the verge of tears when she heard a friendly voice say, "I know exactly where that address is. I can take you there."
Michelle recognized the man as Ariel Castro. He was her friend Emily's father. He was also the man who would keep her locked away in a torture chamber for 11 years.
This is Hostage, a Parcast original. Every week, we tell the stories behind the most captivating hostage situations and the people inside them.
And we'll also cover the psychological tactics used in kidnapping situations and what the human brain does when held captive.
I'm Irma Blanco.
And I'm Carter Roy.
You can find episodes of Hostage and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. To stream Hostage for free on Spotify, just open the app and type Hostage in the search bar.
At Parcast, we are grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network.
And if you enjoyed today's episode, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review wherever you're listening. It really does help. This is the first of 2 episodes chronicling how kidnapper and abuser Ariel Castro abducted, imprisoned, and sexually assaulted 3 women for over a decade in Cleveland, Ohio.
Ariel Castro's victim survived unspeakable torture in a boarded-up house at 2207 Seymour Avenue. The women endured starvation, multiple pregnancies, and the uncertainty of whether or not they would live to see their families again.
In today's episode, we cover the struggles of Michelle Knight's childhood and early adulthood, which set the stage for her kidnapping.
We'll also delve into Ariel Castro's formative years in Puerto Rico and into his history of abuse towards his wife, Grimilda Figueroa, and their 4 children.
Next week, we'll delve into the lives of Castro's other 2 victims, Amanda Berry and Gina De Jesus.
Born on July 10, 1960, Ariel Castro was the youngest son of Pedro Castro and Lillian Rodriguez. The Castro family had lived in a small village outside of Yauco, Puerto Rico for years, accumulating land which they passed down through generations. But despite this inherited property, The Castros existed in near squalor without electricity or running water.
During Ariel's early childhood, his father, Pedro, had harbored a long-standing affair with a young neighbor. Ultimately, this affair resulted in four other children, and Lillian soon discovered Pedro's other family.
Upon confronting Pedro, Pedro declared to Lillian that he was leaving her and their children for good. He immediately moved out of the home and in with a young woman and his four other children.
Hurt and dejected, Lillian divorced Pedro. Soon after, she immigrated to Pennsylvania, leaving four-year-old Ariel and his three siblings in Puerto Rico. Ariel would later write, "I was abandoned by my father and later by my mother. My grandma raised me."
According to interviews with Ariel Castro, he was raised with very little adult supervision. He claimed to have been subjected to sexual abuse at the hands of another boy, a 9-year-old family friend, when he was just 5 years old. Years later, when asked about his abuse and why he never spoke to anyone about it, he confessed in an eerily prophetic way, stating, "People who are abused keep quiet. So I did."
2 years after leaving Puerto Rico, Lillian sent for her four children. And in 1966, at 6 years old, Ariel moved to the United States. Almost as soon as they arrived, Lillian started verbally and physically abusing her kids daily, using her open hand, belts, and even sticks to discipline them. Ariel once told a psychiatrist that he would often ask God for her to die.
However, during his abuse, Ariel would come to find comfort in music. One fateful Christmas, Ariel's uncle, Julio Castro, or Ceci, came to visit the family with presents for his nephews. He gifted Ariel a little guitar, and Ariel's love for music blossomed. He would regularly entertain the Castros at family gatherings, and it was evident to his uncle that Ariel had a gift. His talent for playing the bass came naturally.
In 1968, when Ariel was 8 years old, his father moved his new family to Cleveland for a fresh start in America. He was soon joined by two of his brothers, and the family opened a handful of small businesses, including a used car lot, a grocery store, and even a Latino record shop.
The Castro brothers flourished in Cleveland with their entrepreneurial pursuits. And soon, Pedro and Ceci reestablished the preeminence of the Castro family name that they once enjoyed in Puerto Rico.
Despite the bad blood between Ariel's parents, in 1970, Ariel's mother, Lillian, also relocated her family to Cleveland. In 1976, 16-year-old Ariel attended Lincoln West High School and thrived. He was a popular, well-liked student, and soon he joined his first Latin band called Los Tainos as the bass player.
After graduating high school, Ariel began playing around the city and earned himself the reputation of a skilled and respected musician in Cleveland's Latin music scene. Not long after, in 1980, 20-year-old Ariel took a liking to a shy neighborhood girl named Grimilda Figueroa. Grimilda, or Nilda, was just 17 at the time and lived down the street with her five siblings.
Nilda fell for Ariel right away, and the Figueroa family was delighted that she had found someone kind to take care of her. Their relationship moved quickly, and Nilda soon got pregnant. She gave birth to their first child, Ariel Anthony Castro Jr., in September of 1981. According to Nilda's sister, Alida, Ariel treated Nilda well. He was real good to her, but this would only last for a little while.
It was shortly after becoming a father at 21 that Ariel started exhibiting controlling and irrationally possessive behavior towards Nilda. He frequently demanded that she bring their infant son to a club where Ariel played nightly gigs so that he could show him off. If she refused, brutality would follow.
One of the first times Ariel attacked Nilda was during a simple disagreement. Nilda later described this initial abuse, saying, He just punched me in the face and grabbed me by the head and threw me back against the concrete floor. The second time, he punched me so hard that he broke my nose.
Nilda was terrified of what Ariel might do next if she told even her close family about how he'd beaten her. In order to cover up any traces of her injuries, she became skilled at using makeup to conceal black eyes and bruises. She would even wrap her face tightly in a scarf in an attempt to obscure the damage Ariel had done to her the night before.
When Nilda got pregnant for the second time in 1982 with their daughter Angie, his rage grew. One time, when Nilda was slow to clean up the kitchen due to morning sickness, Ariel punched her in the mouth, knocking out her two front teeth.
Before Ariel would allow Nilda to be taken to the hospital for treatment, he demanded that she promise not to report his abuse. This was Ariel's routine, no matter how severe the injury. After one particularly violent attack, when Nilda was required to get 40 stitches for a head wound, Ariel still refused to let her seek treatment until she vowed never to say a word.
Nilda would later explain, "That's the only way he would let me into the hospital. He wanted me to die that day. He wanted me to bleed to death." Eventually, doctors at Grace Hospital, where Nilda frequently sought treatment, had grown familiar with Nilda and her injuries. It became clear that she was the victim of domestic violence. However, without her consent, they could not report the abuse to authorities. Their hands were tied.
Even when the couple moved into Nilda's father's home to save money, Ariel's brutal temper didn't subside. His violence against Nilda continued to build, reaching dangerous proportions. Nilda routinely rushed herself to the emergency room for a shattered rib, broken nose, or multiple serious concussions.
In 1988, Nilda gave birth to their third child, a girl named Emily. In order to keep up with the demands of his growing family, Ariel had found work as a driver at Kumba Motors. But in 1990, with the birth of Ariel and Nilda's fourth child, Arlene, money was growing tight.
The now burgeoning family of six was crammed into a tiny apartment. Then, just 2 years later in 1990, Ariel was fired.
Ariel was 30, a father of four, and unemployed. Desperate for work, he decided to apply to become a school bus driver for the Cleveland Board of Education.
On his application, when asked what qualified him for the position, Ariel simply wrote, "I enjoy working with children." Ariel was officially hired by the Cleveland School District in February of 1991.
In 1992, with the money he'd earned as a bus driver and from playing various music gigs, Ariel Castro bought his first home. He purchased a house at 2207 Seymour Drive from his uncle Edwin for $12,000.
The house was a small two-story with five bedrooms and an unfinished basement. The neighborhood was populated with Puerto Rican immigrants and was rife with drug use, especially crack.
Now, in the privacy of his own property, Ariel unleashed a whole new reign of terror on his family. He put heavy padlocks on all the windows and doors to keep them in the house anytime he left. With no key to open the locks, even in emergencies, Nilda and the children were completely trapped.
But Ariel's behavior took a truly psychotic turn when he bought a female mannequin. He would often dress the dummy up in wigs and dresses and drive around with it sitting in the back seat of his sports car, scaring the hell out of passersby in the neighborhood.
At night, the mannequin was routinely brought inside where Ariel would place it, alone, in a far room of the house. It was a reminder of what would happen to any of his family if they dared step out of line. According to his son, Ariel would often threaten them, saying, "Act up again, and you'll be in that back room with the mannequin."
1993 marked the beginning of the end of Ariel's marriage to Nilda. After a particularly violent argument, 33-year-old Ariel threw Nilda down the steps, cracking her skull from front to back. He had pushed her down the staircase dozens of times, but after this occasion, Nilda started suffering from seizures.
Nilda was quickly admitted to the Cleveland Clinic for an operation when surgeons found she had a blood clot in her brain. The clot had hardened into a meningioma, a difficult tumor that could not be removed during surgery. Later, doctors told Nilda that the tumor would eventually prove fatal.
Not long after her surgery, while Nilda was still recovering, Ariel attacked her again in a fit of drunken rage. Their terrified son, Ariel Jr., ran outside the house to summon the police. When officers arrived, Ariel Sr. was found hiding a few doors down the street.
Reaching her breaking point, Nilda gathered the courage to sign a misdemeanor complaint against Ariel. He was then immediately taken to the 2nd District Police Station and booked.
By the next morning, Nilda's resolve had melted yet again, and she asked for all domestic violence charges against Ariel to be dropped. Shortly after, he was released on $25,000 bail.
In 1994, a grand jury declined to try 34-year-old Ariel without Nilda's testimony, and the courts were forced to drop the charges. Ariel maintained a clean domestic record during their marriage. Years later, Nilda would admit that Ariel had threatened to kill her and their children if she testified against him.
According to the National Intimate Partner and Sexual Violence Survey, 1 in 4 women have been victim to physical violence at the hands of an intimate partner. However, only 21% of these victims report their abuse to an authority, such as a doctor or nurse, within their lifetime. Fear of retaliation from their abusers was one of the leading reasons why this abuse went unreported.
A few days later, Ariel moved out of the house on Seymour Avenue and in with his mother and 2 brothers. However, he soon returned to attack Nilda once more. Nilda finally left and took the children to live with her grandmother, never to return to Seymour Avenue again.
As soon as his family had left, Ariel immediately got to work adapting the house for his future plans. He began by installing chain-link fences on the house's perimeter, creating what would soon be his personal torture chamber.
While living alone, Ariel's obsession with his sadistic desires grew. He was growing restless to find a victim upon whom he could act out his increasingly demented fantasies. It was only a matter of time before he went out looking for someone to take Nilda's place. But on August 23rd, 2002, his new victim would come to him.
He ran smack into a vulnerable young woman, lost and wanting directions in the downtown dollar store. It seemed to Ariel that their destinies had collided, and he was ready to attack.
After the break, we'll detail the serendipitous events that landed Michelle Knight squarely in Ariel Castro's path.
Now, back to the story.
Michelle Knight was born on April 23rd, 1981, with anything but a silver spoon in her mouth. Like a band of modern-day nomads, she and her family lived out of a dirty brown station wagon. Her parents posted up in the front seat, while Michelle was packed in with her younger twin brothers and her cousin Mickey in the back. Her dad would often park the wagon alongside an apple orchard, and the family would pick their breakfast, lunch, and dinner off the trees.
Michelle didn't know why they were homeless. She learned early on not to question her parents, or adults, too much about anything. Her mother's child-rearing philosophy was rooted in, children should be seen and not heard.
After living a year in the car, the Knight family eventually upgraded into a house situated in the middle of a drug-infested neighborhood populated with pimps and sex workers. However, it was far from a single-family home. When the Knights moved in, the house was bursting at the seams with a total of 12 people, some family, some not.
Michelle's preteen years were rife with instability and chaos. She never had a bedroom to call her own. Most nights she had to find a spare mattress, couch, or empty corner of the crowded house to make her bed for the evening.
Michelle's living situation made her especially vulnerable to a sexual predator living in the house. Though Michelle never named her abuser, she identified that he was a male family member. This relative would often find wherever she had curled up that night, wait until everyone in the house had fallen asleep, and then molest her. Michelle endured this abuse for several years without ever uttering a word to anyone.
According to child abuse specialist Beverly Engel, the sense of shame that comes with abuse often causes victims to turn inward with their suffering. Understanding more about shame can help explain why women blame themselves for their perpetrator's actions rather than seeking help. Engel explains that shame is often the key reason why more women don't report their sexual abuse.
According to Engel, shame often makes a sexual assault or harassment victim feel exposed and unworthy. Because they can't explain the actions of their abuser, they take on what Engel describes as an underlying and pervasive belief that they are defective or unacceptable.
At home, Michelle's only refuge from the hell she was experiencing was to steal some time alone to draw, listen to pop and R&B, and dance by herself. But by the time Michelle turned 15, she had reached her breaking point. She began hatching a plan to run away. But first, she needed to find a way around her assailant.
One night, as her abuser watched pornography on TV, Michelle laid in wait next to him. When the right moment came, she stealthily slipped sleeping pills in his drink. Then she waited, pretending to be asleep as she watched him take sip after sip of his now drugged cocktail.
Finally, he nodded off to sleep, and Michelle seized her chance to escape. She slid down to the bottom of the bed and onto the floor, then ran to her twin brother's room where she hid her purple backpack stuffed with supplies. She dressed in layers to prepare for the chill outside, but had no coat.
Michelle entered the first floor bathroom and looked out on the vast backyard that seemed to go on forever in the dark. Outside was freedom. After several tries, the window came loose and the biting cold hit her in the face. Michelle steeled her nerves, tucked her body through the opening, and stole away into the night.
Michelle spent the next week sleeping under a bus bench, a highway overpass, and even in an empty trash can to keep out of harm's way. Without a coat or blanket, she nearly froze to death.
But one night, while sleeping under the bridge, Michelle was discovered by a small-time drug dealer named Sniper. He took her into his home, allowed her to clean up, and sleep in a real bed and room of her own, all with the intention of grooming her to be his drug runner. He taught Michelle how to shoot a .22 caliber Glock and how to collect money in drug deals.
For about 5 months, Michelle ran drugs for Sniper. She ate well and briefly enjoyed the niceties that having a steady cash flow provided. That was until one day when Sniper got shot by police during a deal. Michelle was once again out on the streets and living under the bridge.
As fate would have it, she soon ran into a family member who then alerted Michelle's father of her whereabouts, landing her right back in the middle of the chaotic home she had just left, reliving the nightmare of her abuse.
But at school, things were different. Michelle met a boy. Eric, the pseudonym Michelle uses for the boy in her memoir, was a handsome football-playing senior. He seemed to genuinely like Michelle and worked hard to gain her trust. Eric was the first boy to ever make Michelle feel pretty or to tell her that he loved her. He was also her first lover.
Unfortunately, Michelle soon learned that Eric had had a girlfriend all along. Michelle eventually broke things off with Eric, but not before she became pregnant. She was 17 and terrified of supporting a baby. However, she decided to keep the child, but not tell Eric.
Baby Joey, who Michelle nicknamed Huggy Bear, was born in October of 1999. His birth was the happiest moment of Michelle's life and would provide her the love she so desperately craved. However, having a child would prove to be a piece of the unfortunate puzzle that led her straight into Ariel Castro's hands.
Still living in the chaotic house with her family, Michelle did her best to raise and protect Joey. Her parents had split up, and her mother moved her new boyfriend, who Michelle refers to as Carlos in her memoir, into the house. One day, Carlos was drunk and got a little rough with Joey when the baby peed himself. Carlos yanked his tiny leg too hard and fractured it.
Michelle rushed Joey to the hospital and, in a panic, told the staff Joey's injuries were the result of a fall in the park. However, Carlos eventually confessed to them that it was his fault.
A social worker informed Michelle that once her son was released from the hospital's care, he would be placed in the foster system until they could determine if his home was a safe place for him to continue living.
This devastated Michelle. Upon hearing the news, she doubled over in the hospital hallway and wept uncontrollably. The next day, when she was forced to hand him off to social services, Joey pitched a fit, screaming over and over, "Don't leave me, Mommy." Despite all the unimaginable pain Michelle had experienced up until that point, it was the worst thing that ever happened to her.
To get Joey back, Michelle was required to attend regular meetings with a social service caseworker in order to prepare for an upcoming custody hearing. But on August 23, 2002, Michelle found herself lost on the way to the appointment. With no money and no car, she wandered into a dollar store in the hopes that she could get directions.
After no luck, Michelle finally heard a familiar voice offering her a ride to the address. When she looked up, Michelle recognized the man as Ariel Castro, her friend Emily's father.
When Michelle followed him to his worn orange Chevy truck, she dismissed the uneasy feeling growing in her gut. She convinced herself that everything would be okay. It was just Emily's dad.
As they were driving, Ariel told Michelle that he had to quickly stop by his house. Even though she was already late to her appointment, Michelle agreed to make a quick detour. Ariel was particularly adept at assuaging Michelle's fears by claiming his daughter Emily would be at the house also.
Ariel then introduced a new, exciting topic of conversation in order to distract Michelle. He asked her if she liked puppies. When she said yes, Ariel told her he had a litter of puppies at his house and that he would give her one to give to Joey.
Before she knew it, Ariel had pulled the van into the trash-littered backyard of a Seymour Avenue home. He escorted Michelle into the filthy home under the guise of picking out the perfect puppy for her son. Once inside the upstairs bedroom, Ariel slammed the door shut behind her. Michelle screamed.
Ariel moved quickly, covering her mouth and nose, practically crushing her skull between his hands. Michelle's two decades of life flashed through her mind as he yanked her hands behind her back and pushed her to the ground. The soft-spoken man she had known just minutes before had become a madman.
Michelle's thoughts spiraled out of control as Ariel left the bedroom. And when he returned with a heavy orange extension cord, Michelle panicked. She struggled to get up, but Ariel ordered her to stay still. He then grabbed her legs and wrapped the cord so tightly around them that it cut into her flesh.
Michelle cried and writhed in pain. How could this be happening? Next, Ariel proceeded to hogtie her with the cords, tethering her wrists to her bound ankles. Finally, he looped the cable around her neck, severely blocking her airways. As she lay there helpless, Ariel was sweating and breathing rapidly. He then pulled down his pants and proceeded to masturbate.
He talked to Michelle the whole time, saying things like, "You're only going to be here for a little while," and, "I just really want us to be friends." And finally, "My wife and kids left me, and all I want is for someone to be here for me. I need you."
Nothing she had ever experienced before had come close to the terror Michelle felt lying on the floor in that moment. She was sure she was going to die.
Afterwards, Ariel dragged Michelle in between two metal poles that were placed on each side of the room, attached by a clothesline. Ariel took his second extension cord and tethered it to the clothesline and poles. He then raised Michelle up off the ground until she hung there suspended, facing a window. Lastly, he stuffed a sock inside her mouth and secured it with duct tape. All she could do was moan.
Ariel then left, but before doing so, he turned up the volume of the radio so loud that it threatened to damage Michelle's eardrums. Alone and dizzy from suspension, Michelle only had her thoughts. Was anyone out there looking for her? Would she ever see her baby boy Joey again? She had no idea.
She could see through the windows of the neighbors, but it was obvious they couldn't see her. For hours, she was left suspended. Her limbs passed from numbness to feeling as though 1,000 pins and needles were stabbing her flesh. Hanging there, she stared at the mermaid painted on the floor of the room that once belonged to Ariel's daughter.
As the sun went down, Michelle grew more and more certain that when he returned, Ariel Castro would kill her.
In a moment, Michelle endures the beginning of her new life in captivity and soon finds she's not alone. Now, back to the story.
On August 23rd, 2002, 21-year-old Michelle Knight was kidnapped by Ariel Castro after asking for directions to her social worker's office. Desperate, Michelle had accepted Ariel's offer for a ride. It was a decision that would cost her dearly.
While Michelle waited, helplessly suspended in the air while hog-tied with extension cords, she thought of her son. Morning came, then afternoon, and then another night passed. Hungry, thirsty, soaked in her own urine, and barely able to breathe due to the cable around her neck, she waited.
Finally, Ariel showed up carrying a bag of McDonald's, but Michelle refused to eat, worried that he would likely poison her. He undid the cord around her arms and neck, and Michelle hit the floor. Pain shot through her entire body.
Ariel picked her up and took her to the adjacent room, where he threw her on a dirty, stained mattress and stripped off her clothes. He then proceeded to sexually assault Michelle for the next hour. She screamed over and over, desperately kicking and scratching Ariel, but her small 4'7" frame was powerless underneath him.
After Ariel exhausted himself, he laid down next to Michelle and started talking to her, as if the moment were his private confessional. As Michelle laid paralyzed next to him, Ariel told her about his own abuse, saying, "I got molested when I was a little kid, and nobody did nothing about it. I just want one person to stay here with me."
Ariel was a classic case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. He vacillated between attempts to gain Michelle's sympathy and claims that he would let her go, to tormenting her just as she was about to get up and leave. In those first nights he held her captive, Ariel subjected Michelle to horrific mind games.
Ariel would throw money at Michelle and call her a prostitute when she tried to leave. And when he rummaged through her purse and discovered she was 21 and not the teenager he had hoped his victim would be, Ariel accused Michelle of tricking him. He would also tell her in his lunacy that they were just going to be friends. He'd feed Michelle false promises, saying, "You're not going to be here with me no real long time, just until Christmas."
That's when the reality of it all hit Michelle. She was trapped. She was Ariel's prisoner. Feeling as if she had almost nothing to lose, Michelle rebuffed his advances and Ariel flew into a rage, dragging her by the hair down the staircase. She thought wherever he was taking her and whatever he was planning to do couldn't be worse than what she had just endured. But she was mistaken. Ariel was taking her to the basement.
Michelle could barely see in the dim light of the single lit bulb. The cement floor was filthy and the air was so thick with mildew she could hardly breathe. Ariel began wrapping heavy chains around her small body, and to keep her from being heard if she screamed, he shoved a thick black motorcycle helmet onto her head. He then told her that if he was able to trust her again, he would loosen the chains.
For the next several months, Ariel would come downstairs after driving kids around in a school bus and proceed to violently abuse Michelle. Morning, noon, and night, she sat in the dark, chained, filthy, and forced to relieve herself in a bucket.
For a time, Ariel would bring her sausage sandwiches, and soon the basement floor was littered with yellow McDonald's wrappers. Sometimes, he fed her spaghetti with red sauce on top that his mother had made when she visited. But most of the time, all she received were the scraps of a meal gone rancid.
Michelle kept track of time by what outfit Ariel had on when he came downstairs. Maroon shirt and khaki pants meant it was a weekday and he was working his bus driving job. Regular jeans and a t-shirt meant it was the weekend.
On the weekends, Ariel would invite his bandmates over. They would have extremely loud jam sessions upstairs, all while Michelle sat chained and listening just below their feet.
Ariel tormented Michelle to break her spirit, telling her that no one in the outside world was looking for her, that she was nothing and no one cared about her existence.
Which, sadly, seemed to be the case. Knight would later learn that for years, few people outside of her family knew that she was even missing.
When she was first kidnapped, a missing persons report was filed by Michelle's family, but authorities soon dismissed her disappearance as a runaway case. After 15 months, her name was officially removed from the FBI's database of missing people when police could not reach her mother to confirm that she was still unaccounted for.
One day, with no explanation, Ariel decided to move Michelle back upstairs. Michelle didn't dare ask questions when he returned her to the pink room and padlocked and chained her to the dirty mattress. She knew if she uttered a single word, she would return directly to the basement.
The upstairs bedroom may have given Michelle a respite from the darkness of the basement, but it did not give her reprieve from the violence. Ariel's abuse continued daily. Michelle continued to plead with him to stop and let her go, or to let her see her son. But again and again, her pleas fell on deaf ears.
After his nightly abuse session, as he laid next to Michelle, it became Ariel's routine to be chatty. He opened up to her as if they were friends or consensual lovers. He talked about his childhood abuse or being bullied by kids in his neighborhood growing up. Once, in a moment of self-reflection, he told Michelle, "I can't help myself. I have to hurt you."
Years later, during Ariel's trial, he would blame his actions on sexual compulsion. When questioned on the stand, he stated, "I'm sick. My sexual problems have been so bad on my mind. I'm impulsive."
According to sex addiction specialist Robert Weiss, Ariel used claims of sex addiction to excuse his horrendous behavior. Weiss said in an NBC News article, without remorse, without empathy, without a consistent pattern of compulsive and addictive behavior that involved different settings over time, I don't see a sex addict. I just see a psychopath and a sex offender.
No matter what Michelle said to try and convince Ariel to let her go, he would never relent. At times when he seemed ready to release her, at the last possible moment, he'd always return to his twisted reasons for why she had to stay. He would tell her, "You're not supposed to be sad. I want you to be happy here with me. We're supposed to be a family."
On the nights when Ariel would pass out next to her, Michelle would try to figure out a way to slip from underneath him and unchain herself. But every time she would move an inch, he would grunt and then grip her waist tighter.
In order to cope with the constant abuse, Michelle desperately tried to keep her mind occupied. She would habitually conjure up memories of her son, Joey, and recall the many happy moments they had together, the first steps he took, Christmas and birthdays. Eventually, Michelle started having visions that Joey was in the room with her.
To Ariel's dismay, he often found Michelle talking out loud to the invisible Joey as if he were really there. In an attempt to stop her delusions, Ariel brought her a radio, and then finally, upon request, a puppy. He was desperate for Michelle to stop talking to her imaginary son.
The puppy gave Michelle life. It became her best friend and single reason to keep hope alive. Ariel would routinely take the puppy, a small pit bull, outside to do its business and return him to her. Michelle named him Lobo and grew to depend on him for the love she was so starved for.
But unfortunately, Michelle's time with Lobo was short-lived. One night, while Ariel was sexually assaulting her in a fit of drunken rage, the puppy went nuts. He began barking and biting Ariel, trying to defend Michelle from the attack.
But in one fell swoop, Ariel grabbed the puppy and broke his neck, killing him instantly. He discarded Lobo's body in the backyard. Michelle was devastated.
For several more winter months, Michelle continued to endure Ariel's abuse. He forced her to live naked, chained up, and freezing in the upstairs bedroom. When she pleaded for clothes, he yelled at her, reminding her that she was not there to be warm, but to service him.
After 7 months of captivity, Ariel exhibited his characteristic Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde personality. He finally allowed Michelle to keep a TV in her room and even take a shower. Both privileges were a surprise and unprovoked.
One day, as she was watching TV, Michelle happened to see a news report stating that a 16-year-old girl named Amanda Berry had gone missing.
Michelle suddenly felt a sinking feeling in her gut. Ariel was spending a lot of time in the other bedroom lately, getting it ready for something. Michelle knew who he was preparing it for.
Thanks again for tuning into Hostage. Next week, Michelle meets Amanda Berry, Ariel Castro's second victim, while the outside world launches a search for the missing girls.
You can find more episodes of Hostage and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify.
Not only does Spotify already have all your favorite music, but now Spotify is making it easy for you to enjoy all your favorite Parcast originals, like Hostage, for free from your phone, desktop, or smart speaker.
To stream Hostage on Spotify, just open the app and type Hostage in the search bar.
And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. We'll see you next time.
In the meantime, don't take your freedom for granted.
Hostage was created by Max Cutler and is a production of Cutler Media and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound design by Dick Schroeder, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro, Maggie Admire, and Travis Clark. This episode of Hostage is written by Kenyetta Raylan and stars Irma Blanco and Carter Roy.